Hello and welcome to Greatest Britons. Today's date is Wednesday, the 11th of March, 2020, and you're listening to me, Sven Longshanks, broadcasting at RadioAlbion.com. Well, today is going to be the first of a new series called Greatest Britons, where we will check out the people in British history that myself and Max Musson think really epitomise what it means to be British. And you may have heard these before on the Aryan Britannia series, where they formed a small segment out of that podcast. And what I have done is edit all these sections together so that we have complete podcasts detailing the lives of these amazing men and women. And the first one today that we're going to begin with is Captain William Bligh. Let's get into our British archetype that we've got for us today. We're going to be talking about Captain Bligh. And the reason why we picked Captain Bligh is because he has a connection to Captain Cook last week. And actually, it was House Carl in the chat room who suggested we do Captain Bligh. He said that he's a particular figure from history that he always seen as very heroic for what he did, and he's the chap that he was the captain on the Bounty where there was a mutiny. Obviously there's been a film made of this, and he rather heroically managed to make sure that his crew and him were safe after travelling 4,000 miles with very little provisions. And we'll get into the details of that as we go along here. Had you heard of Captain Bligh before? I guess you must have heard of Mutiny on the Bounty, Max.
Yes, I had. And he is, as you say, another one of these boys' own heroes that has existed for and been written about for over many, many generations, although much less so in recent times. And in recent times, there's been more sort of focus in particularly in films about the Mutiny on the Bounty. There's been more focus on the sort of titillation over the fact that a number of the sailors that took part in the mutiny did so in order that they could spend time with Polynesian women in Tahiti. And so that there's been a focus on that rather than a focus on the things that Captain Bligh did and the outstanding career that he had as a sailor.
They've also made him out to be like a real bad guy and a strict disciplinarian. And again, that's not true. According to his diaries, I believe in the Mutiny on the Bounty film, they made the mutineers out to be the good guys and made him out to be a really nasty disciplinarian. I can't recall actually. I did watch the movie years ago, but I can't actually recall quite what the plot line was. But when doing the research for this, it did say that in most of the representations of Captain Bligh, they've made him out to be, you know, a nasty character. Whereas he wasn't a nasty character. He was born in Plymouth in 1754, and he signed up for the Navy aged 7. And that was something that your parents would do at that time. They would sign you up for the Navy, and then you would be on to a good career, basically, when you became an adult. He went to sea at aged 16. So he was working on the boats at a very early age, and he was picked by Captain Cook at age 22. He picked him out and said that he wanted him to serve as master on the Resolution. And he was actually on the boat, the Resolution, for 3 years. And that was the boat that Captain Cook took to Hawaii. And you remember last week we said how the savages tried to steal one of the smaller rowing boats from the Resolution, and Captain Cook tried to get this small rowing boat back. Part of the way that he did that was by kidnapping the Hawaiian chief, and while he was doing that, Captain Cook was actually killed. So Captain Bligh, he knew Captain Cook, and he learned from Captain Cook, and Captain Cook was an amazing navigator, basically. So he learned the art of navigation from Captain Cook. He fought in the Battle of Dogger Bank, which was part of the Anglo-Dutch War, and apparently that had a relation to the War of Independence in America that was going on at the time. And he was made lieutenant after that. And then at the age of 29, he became a captain, and he was a captain in the merchant service. And then shortly after that, I think it was 8 years after that, in 1787, Bligh was selected as commander of His Majesty's Armed Transport, the Bounty. And that's the most famous boat that he was the captain of. And the Bounty's log shows that Bligh was a good captain. He was relatively sparing in his punishments. He scolded when other captains would have whipped, and whipped when other captains would have hanged. He was an educated man, deeply interested in science, convinced that good diet and sanitation were necessary for the welfare of his crew. He took a great interest in his crew's exercise, was very careful about the quality of their food, and insisted upon the Bounty being kept very clean. So he was a very good captain, and discipline was really important in those days. I can remember reading about these sailors, and one of the first things they had to do was create their own cat o' nine tails, which was these knotted ropes that would then be used to whip them with if they did anything wrong. And there was this another punishment, which was keel hauling, and they would put you on a rope, and then they would drag you right the way under the boat and back up the other side with all the barnacles that were on there. So very, very, very strict discipline on these ships. You needed to keep strict discipline to prevent things like this mutiny happening. So, you know, this log shows that he was a good guy, and he was a hard worker. So it was, you know, tragic that this should actually happen to him, I think, Max.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, look, going back to, you know, what you were saying about discipline, you've only got to read sort of novels by Jack London, The Mutiny on the Elsinore, The Sea Wolf, to sort of get a picture of the conditions that existed upon ships during that sort of period, that spent long times out at sea, etc. And William Bligh was somebody who quite obviously had learnt a great deal from Captain Cook, and himself was regarded as an expert navigator. And one of the interesting things, really, when you look at the mutiny, is that Bligh was set adrift in a small boat with just I think it was 19 of his crew, which were 19 out of something like about 25 or so who were actually loyal to him. He left behind a very small number of the sailors that were loyal to him, because it was just impossible to get them in the boat with him without the boat sinking, because it was so low in the water with the existing loyal crew and the few food supplies and things they had, that the gunwales were only like a matter of inches above the water. And so there was Bligh set adrift in this boat with very little by way of water, very little by way of food. And I think that the crew had to subsist for a great amount of time on just like a few ounces of bread a day. And yet they managed to make their way, as you say, 4,000 miles to safety. And so when we compare what they went through with the trips that have been taken in more recent times by migrants traveling from North Africa across to the southern coast of Europe, and with migrants that have been trying to make their way across the English Channel, you know, that the 20 miles or so that it is across the English Channel, and the couple of hundred miles that it is or so between the various islands that they sort of island hop across the Mediterranean on, pale into insignificance in comparison with a 4,000 mile journey with people crammed into a relatively small boat with very little in the way of provisions. And so it was quite, you know, just that the journey that was made by Bligh from Tahiti, or the that sort of part of the Pacific Ocean, all the way across to I think it was Timor, that he eventually found safety in, that was in the Dutch East Indies. That was a massive achievement, the fact that they got across there. And I think that the only member of their crew that died during that particular journey was a member of crew where they stopped off at an island that was occupied by natives and were then immediately attacked by the natives. And one of their crew was killed by the natives before they managed to get back in the boats and sort of make their escape. And so, it was a fantastic achievement on his part.
Yeah, I think, back then, people could get on these boats, these young men who had a sense of adventure, it was provided for. You could get on these boats, you could sign up into the Navy, you could learn a trade, you could be a seaman, you could get in the Merchant Navy, you could fight for the king. And that sense of adventure that young men had was utilized for the country. And they had a great sense of patriotism and a great sense of loyalty. I mean, as Captain Bligh, he had a huge sense of loyalty to his men to make sure that they all got back safely. I think some of them got ill afterwards, but he made sure that they all got back. They didn't start eating one another or anything like that, even though they had no supplies there. Well, to get into the details of this, he was, as we remember there, he was given the bounty, and the Royal Society, and I think they had something to do with the Freemasons, actually. The Royal Society commission was to sail to Tahiti to get bread trees, which were to feed the slaves. And that was just the mission on the surface, because secretly it was because Britain and France both wanted Tahiti for themselves. So the Britons wanted to get the bounty actually on Tahiti. And when he was there, he had to wait 5 months for these bread trees to ripen. And the theory is that the crew possibly became corrupted during that 5 months that they had there by the freedom, the idleness, and the sexual license that they discovered there, because these Tahitians were pretty free and easy. And they had come from this society where you were celibate if you weren't married. In fact, that was, probably what inspired a lot of all of this colonizing and this great success of the British Empire, was that these men, they weren't out chasing women. They were celibate, and all that energy was put into adventuring rather than put into having sex all the time. But the mutiny on the Royal Navy vessel HMAV Bounty occurred in the South Pacific Ocean on the 28th of April 1789, led by the master's mate, acting lieutenant Fletcher Christian, who was actually a sort of apprentice to Captain Bligh, and Captain Bligh thought a lot of him. He thought he was his friend. And he was a disaffected crewman that seized control of the ship and set Bligh and 18 loyalists adrift in the ship's open launch. The mutineers variously settled on Tahiti or on Pitcairn Island, and we'll get into that later. Meanwhile, Bligh completed a voyage of more than 3,500 nautical miles, 6,500 kilometres, and that's 4,000 normal miles. Now, I didn't really realise that nautical miles were different to normal miles, but apparently they are. So it was 4,000 miles to the west in the launch to reach safety north of Australia in the Dutch East Indies, modern Indonesia, and began the process of bringing the mutineers to justice. Despite being in the majority, none of the loyalists put up a significant struggle once they saw that Bligh was bound and the ship was taken over without bloodshed. So they just didn't want to fight, I guess. The mutineers provided Bligh and 18 loyal crewmen a 23-foot launch, so that's about 7 metres long, so heavily loaded that the gunwales were only a few inches above the water. They were allowed 4 cutlasses, food and water for perhaps a week, a quadrant and a compass, but no charts or marine chronometer. Most of these were obtained by the clerk, Mr. Samuel, who acted with great calm and resolution despite threats from the mutineers. The launch could not hold all the loyal crew members, so 4 of them were detained on the bounty for their useful skills, and they were later released in Tahiti. So these mutineers, they wanted to just set them adrift on the boat with nothing. But thankfully, because of this this clerk, Mr. Samuel, he managed to get a compass on there and a quadrant. But they still had no charts, so they had to rely on Captain Bligh's memory, I guess, and of what direction that they had to go in. I don't know if they actually went past Australia to get to the Dutch East Indies.
They would have had to have skirted around the northern coast of Australia, but most of Australia would not have been inhabited by Europeans. That part of like Queensland and Darwin would have been occupied by Australian Aborigines.
Yeah, so they would have ended up with the same problems that Captain Cook had, I guess, as we were talking about in the last episode. And they only had four cutlasses, so they didn't even have enough to defend themselves. Now, let's get into the actual voyage itself. Tahiti was upwind from Bligh's initial position and was the obvious destination of the mutineers. So obviously they wanted to go in a different direction. But Timor was the nearest European colonial outpost in the Dutch East Indies, 4,164 miles away. Bligh and his crew first made for Tofua, only a few leagues distant, to obtain supplies. However, they were attacked by hostile natives, and John Norton, a quartermaster, was killed. Fleeing from Tofua, Bligh did not dare to stop at the next islands to the west, which were the Fiji Islands, as he had no weapons for defence and expected a hostile reception. He did, however, keep a log entitled Log of the Proceedings of His Majesty's Ship Bounty, Lieutenant William Bligh, Commander from Otaheite towards Jamaica, which he used to record events from the 5th of April 1789 to the 13th of March 1790. He also made use of a small notebook to sketch a rough map of his discoveries. So he made discoveries while along the way. He's lost all his weapons. He's got nothing that he can defend himself with, and yet he still managed to make it right the way across the ocean. Bligh had confidence in his navigational skills, which he had perfected under the instruction of Captain James Cook. His first responsibility was to bring his men to safety. Thus, he undertook the seemingly impossible 4,164-mile voyage to Timor, the nearest European settlement. Bligh succeeded in reaching Timor after a 47-day voyage, the only casualty being the crewman killed on Tofua. So I guess if he didn't stop anywhere else, they must have gone for 47 days just on what they had there to eat. From the 4th of May until the 29th of May, when they reached the Great Barrier Reef north of Australia, the 18 men lived on a twelfth of a pound. That's 40 grams of bread per day. So they must have rationed it, and they must have had the self-discipline not to eat more than they actually had there. The weather was often stormy, and they were in constant fear of foundering due to the boat's heavily laden condition. On the 29th of May, they landed on a small island off the coast of Australia, which they named Restoration Island. 29th of May 1660 being the date of the restoration of the British monarchy after the English Civil War. So they were great patriots and royalists as well, and they never lost their love of country all the way through this. Over the next week or more, they island hopped north along the Great Barrier Reef, while Bligh, the cartographer as always, sketched maps of the coast. Early in June, they passed through the Endeavour Strait and sailed again on the open sea until they reached Kupang, a settlement on Timor, on 14th of June 1789. Several of the men who survived this arduous voyage with him were so weak that they soon died of sickness, possibly malaria, in the pestilential Dutch East Indies port of Batavia, the present-day Indonesian capital of Jakarta, as they awaited transport to Britain. In October 1790, Bligh was honourably acquitted at the court-martial inquiring into the loss of the Bounty. Shortly thereafter, he published a narrative of the mutiny on board His Majesty's ship Bounty and the subsequent voyage on part of the crew in the ship's boat from Tofua, one of the Friendly Islands, to Timor, a Dutch settlement in the East Indies. And what's really amazing about that is that all the while he was doing this, he was continuing to do his job, basically, his vocation, cartography. He was continuing to map everything that they went past. He was continuing to take records. He never lost faith that he was actually going to get his men to safety.
Amazing, isn't it?
Incredible story here. Do you want to comment on that, Max?
No, I'm just agreeing with you. It is a testament to the man's self-belief and self-discipline, and also the discipline of his men, that they, as you say, maintained the discipline of only eating very small rations as they were going, but then still stayed true to the to the purpose of their original voyage, which was to explore and to map out the seaways and the islands that they encountered.
Well, they must have worked out some way of trapping the dew as well, maybe, to get fresh water. Because if they couldn't land anywhere, do you think?
That's a distinct possibility. I would think there must have been some way that they could have done that. Of course, there may have been periods when it rained. So the fact that they were in a boat and it was in a predominantly warm part of the world doesn't necessarily mean that there won't be any rain. I'm not sure what time of year it was that they made their journey, but it could have coincided with monsoon weather or something of that sort, I suppose.
Yeah, they would have had to have done something because you run out of water first before you before you need to eat. You need to have fresh water. I mean, they must have been starving and really emaciated when they got back. But he did. He got them all back safe and sound, apart from this one that was attacked by the savages. Well, thankfully, he did get some justice. Once he was back, Edward Edwards of the HMS Pandora was sent on the Royal Navy's expedition to the South Pacific to find the mutineers and bring them back to stand trial. And Edwards is often made out to be the cruel man that Hollywood has portrayed Bligh as being. See, I don't know why they portrayed Bligh as being a cruel man, apart from them just, apart from the people in Hollywood just not liking decent, brave, courageous white men. They have to portray them as flawed in some way, I guess. The 14 men from the Bounty who were captured by Edward's men were confined in a cramped 18 foot by 11 foot by 5 foot 8 foot wooden cell on Pandora's quarterdeck. Yet when Pandora ran aground on the Great Barrier Reef, three prisoners were immediately let out of the prison cell to help at the pumps. So he wasn't a bad guy. He let them out. Finally, Captain Edwards gave orders to release the other 11 prisoners, to which end Joseph Hodges, the armourer's mate, went into the cell to remove the prisoner's irons. Unfortunately, before he could finish the job, the ship sank. Four of the prisoners and 31 of the crew died during the sinking. More prisoners would likely have perished had not William Moulter, a boatswain's mate, unlocked their cages before jumping off the sinking vessel himself. Of the 10 surviving prisoners eventually brought home, in spite of Pandora's loss, four were acquitted owing to Bligh's testimony that they were non-mutineers, that Bligh was obliged to leave on the Bounty because of lack of space in the launch. Two others were convicted because, while not participating in the mutiny, they were passive and did not resist. They subsequently received royal pardons. One was convicted but excused on a technicality, and the remaining three were convicted and hanged. And normally on these ships, you had marines there. You actually had some kind of security there, but he was actually the only officer that was on board this ship. So they were expecting the crew to behave themselves. And I guess that's the reason why they had such strong discipline over them. You had to have the crew in a state of fear of what would happen if they did something like this. And it's a real credit to the tenacity of the people that went after them as well, I think. And, and Britain, the British state, saying, well, we must have justice for this. So we're going to send this boat over, even at great risk, to capture these mutineers and bring them back. And you can see how dangerous the voyage is when you've got a full sailing ship like the Pandora, and that runs aground and loads of people drown. And you can just compare that to this small 8 foot launch that was, the gunwales are just a couple of inches above the water, making that same vessel back. I mean, that really brings into relief the danger of it, doesn't it? Of that original voyage, I think.
Yeah, and I think it's like a general sense of duty. One of the things that a lot of people complain about nowadays is the fact that they feel disaffected. They feel that there is the society of which they're a part is corrupted through to the core, and that there's nothing idealistic for them to believe in, nothing bigger than themselves that they can believe in. But during these days that we're talking about here with Captain Bligh and his crew, that there was a very clear sense of duty to something that was bigger than you. First of all, there was a far greater belief in religion in those days, but and so there would have been the firm belief that they had to be good Christians, but then also there would have been this firm belief that they were part of something that was much bigger. They would have been part of the British Empire, and that they would have felt a sense of mission, that they were taking civilization to parts of the world where no comparable civilization actually existed, and they would have had a sense of duty to fulfill the tasks that were allotted to them.
Well, I think they felt safe in the knowledge that the nation that they come from, the country that they would come from, would ensure that they got justice as well. You know, they knew that they could get back, and there would be a court case, and then they would go out and they would get these mutineers, and they would get justice. I mean, so many people just don't get justice today. I mean, the police, I think they only solve 5% of the crimes that get put forward to them. And, you know, the British state could have just said, well, it's too far away. It's right over the other side of the world. It's too risky to go and get these people. But they didn't. They went and got them. And all the while that Bligh and his men were on that voyage, you know, they kept up their belief in king and country. And as I say, you can see that by the way that they named the place that they got to after the king. That, I mean, that was obviously very, very important to them, was that there had been a restoration of the monarchy. Well, let's see what happened to the mutineers, because there's an interesting story there as well. As I said, it was led by Fletcher Christian, who was originally Bligh's protege. Following the mutiny, Christian attempted to build a colony onto Bai, but there the mutineers came into conflict with the natives. Abandoning the island, he stopped briefly in Tahiti, where he married Mamiti, the daughter of one of the local chiefs, on the 16th of June 1789. While on Tahiti, he dropped off 16 crewmen. So that's the 16 crewmen that the Pandora must have brought back. These 16 included 4 Bligh loyalists who had been left behind on the Bounty, and 2 who had neither participated in but nor resisted the mutiny. The remaining 9 mutineers, 6 Tahitian men and 11 Tahitian women, then sailed eastwards. In time, they landed on Pitcairn Island, where they stripped the Bounty of all that could be floated ashore before Matthew Quintal set it on fire, stranding them. The resulting sexual imbalance, combined with the effective enslavement of the Tahitian men by the mutineers, led to insurrection and the deaths of most of the men, as they all fell out, killed one another, or died through a drunken mishap. One of them was so intoxicated he fell off a cliff, and others of them shot one another. I mean, this shows you that these are men of low character, basically. So when you leave them alone together, they, instead of being like Bligh with his men in the vessel, and they all get back safe and sound, you've got these guys that are all falling out with one another over the women, shooting one another, getting drunk, real low characters, basically. And because it was white men and Tahitian women, of course they produced mixed-race children. And I guess you could say that it's probably one of the smallest nations on earth, these Pitcairns, these Pitcairners, this mixed-race people. And what happened to them is interesting as well. The Mongol descendants then populated the island, and they actually became the first nation to give women the vote, which was back in about 1850. They actually gave women the vote. And then in the last century, in the 20th century, a third of the island's population were all prosecuted for child rape in 2004. And that was practically all of the adult males on the island. And they actually had to build a jail for some of them. And there was all this confusion over who is the jurisdiction over it. Is it British? Because, I mean, these were mutineers. They don't actually come under British law. So there was all this confusion over that. But, you know, it's just, you know, it just seems to me that this is the end result of mongrelization. You know, you've just get child rape at the end of it. Half the population prosecuted for child rape.
That's absolutely right. There's a distinct difference in character between the two groups. The group under Fletcher Christian, who became debauched as a result of their sort of lifestyle that they'd chosen for themselves, and the group of men under William Bly, who self-sacrificed and stayed true to their mission and who made it back and were eventually exonerated. So it's a clear distinction between what happens. And it's really, in microcosm, it's a demonstration of the actions that create civilization and the actions that destroy civilization.
I think debauched is a good word to use there for them as well. That's what they become. And also, I believe, and that wasn't the end of the story of Captain Bly. He was also notable for something called the Rum Rebellion. Do you want to talk a little bit about that, Max?
Yeah, I haven't got a lot of detail about the Rum Rebellion, but it was just interesting to note that some years later, this was at the end of the Napoleonic Wars, because Captain Bligh had gone back to the UK. He had taken up service under Admiral Nelson during a number of sea battles, and during the Battle of Copenhagen, he distinguished himself during the course of that conflict. But then, as the Napoleonic Wars came to an end, he was appointed the Governor of New South Wales, where he was sent out there with the mission had been to bring under control and to regulate regulate the production of rum in New South Wales, which had become very corrupted, and there was widespread corruption, particularly amongst the British troops who had been sent out there to New South Wales. And as a result of arriving and then trying to institute discipline and in trying to stamp out the corruption that existed, so there was another rebellion against William Bligh. I've not got the name to hand of the person who or the people who led the rebellion, but effectively Captain Bligh was again sort of put under house arrest, eventually he managed to escape and fled to Tasmania, where he then managed to get a boat back to England. And again, there was another inquiry. And just like with the first inquiry that was into the mutiny on the Bounty, so the mutiny that had happened in New South Wales was found to have been, Bligh was exonerated of any blame for the mutiny that had taken place. And it was judged that he had behaved properly and appropriately throughout the whole thing. And it was then subsequent to that, I believe, that he was then promoted to the rank of admiral, although he kind of served within the sort of naval offices here in the UK and didn't actually have a ship beyond that point. But he became an admiral, and then very sadly died in sort of 1814. And there is a tomb, which is in Sackler Garden in London.
I mean, it's amazing. You're looking at the two, isn't it? The two different like British archetypes that you've got there, the debauched, drunkard, barbaric archetype, and then you've got the courageous, virtuous, honourable archetype of the British man, the fearless man that does his best to look after his crew. He knows he's got men that are under him and he's responsible for their welfare. And that also comes across with the way that he kept the ship clean, and he made sure that they ate the right food, and he understood that disease came from not being hygienic and not eating the right food. So he saw these people as he was responsible for them. He was responsible for their welfare. If anything happened to them, it looked bad upon himself. So, in a way, he was selfless in doing that and showing his courage. Whereas on the other side, you've got the debauched archetype, and we want nationalists to be this courageous archetype, virtuous people that understand that we have that capability within us. And as I was saying at the beginning, back then young men had the chance to go abroad and have these adventures, and we don't have that now, but we still have that ability within us to be, you know, the type of people that are responsible and that look out for other people and that do the right thing and set a good example. And that's what we should be doing as nationalists. That's how we will get other people to want to be nationalists as well. You know, you're a representative of your nation, you're a representative of your country, and you want to set a good example. That's why it's important, I think, that we learn about these ancestors. And this is what they should be teaching the kids in schools. They should be saying, this is your identity. This is where you come from. These are the sort of people whose blood you have in your veins. You know, what amazing things are you going to do with your life? You know, instead of telling them that they're just responsible for slavery and colonialism, you know, they want to be telling them about these incredible people that we have in our past and that we are descended from them. You know, we can't actually be any different to them, can we?
No, you're absolutely correct. And this really brings us back full circle to what we were saying about the Extinction Rebellion. You know, the children in our schools, instead of being shown the wonderful examples that various figures in our history have set, they're being told that the end of the world is coming in 12 years' time, and that human beings are destroying the planet, which is just absolute nonsense. We might be changing the environment in certain parts of the planet, but we're not destroying the planet. And so the vision that's being instilled in the minds of our young people nowadays is increasingly becoming distorted and perverted. Whereas if our education system was fulfilling its proper function, which is not just to educate children and to fill their minds with knowledge, but the education system had as its task to create people who are dynamic and outgoing, the sort of people who want to break new ground and explore and go where no man has gone before. And that is the kind of person that everybody actually admires at the end of the day. People don't admire the kind of people who survive and thrive in a decadent and declining society, the sort of people who are ducking and diving and betraying and cheating their fellow man. Nobody admires people like that. And yet there are so many films that are being made, you know, I mean, a film that epitomizes all that sort of thing I saw not so long ago was, well, I actually watched part of it. I couldn't bear to watch the whole film. Actually, it was the Wolf of Wall Street. But you know, when you see films of that sort where people who are utterly debauched and who are corrupted to the very core, when you see films like that that kind of glorify the lives that those sort of people have, you know, it's utterly wrong. And we should be glorifying people such as William Bligh and such as Captain Cook, who did great things in the past and who are archetypes that should stand as an example to our children, to inspire them to do similar great things.
That's the thing. It's inspiration, isn't it? You know, school should not just be about education, but it should inspire the youth, and you know, a sense of patriotism is what is That's needed right. to inspire us and learning about these, you know, these great heroes we had in our past. Well, I hope you enjoyed that. Thank you very much for listening. Do tune in again tomorrow for more of The Greatest Britons.